I always knew who I was to everybody else. And at the end of the day, I was always the last to me.
Welcome to another edition of the Hey, Where'd You Go podcast. I'm Colin Kushner, and we have a fantastic guest, a very long list of accomplishments, four-time Stanley Cup champ. He's a broadcaster, a rock star, an author, and you know what? So many more things. We'll let him get into it. He is Darren McCarty. What's up, brother? How are you?
What's up, Colin? Nice to be with you, bro.
How are you doing, and how's the family in Michigan?
Everybody's good. The weather's starting to get a little bit nicer. Golf season's around the corner. Anything with green on it, I'm all about. So we're all good here, bro. But we're all about this right now, and love what you're doing, and it's great to be able to connect.
You grew up in Leamington, Ontario, which is really close to Detroit. What was Leamington like? Explain where you're from.
Obviously, I was born out in Burnaby, British Columbia. The fact that same hospital as Joe Sakic, he got all the talent, but we took a bunch of cups out of there. So, but I grew up, my parents got divorced, and I grew up in Southern Ontario. Actually, when I was 5 years old, my mom remarried to Craig McCarty, and that's, he adopted me, and that's where I took the name. And Leamington, give or take, the house I grew up in, give or take 10 minutes for the Detroit Windsor border, took me 40 minutes to get to Joe Louis Arena. So I was going to Olympia. I remember in the 70s, I went to a game at Olympia. I went to more Tiger games. I was a bigger Tiger fan growing up. But obviously, the Wings back in the day we were talking before is that we've all had Steve Yzerman jerseys. When I was 10 years old, he was drafted to the Wings. And, you know, the first, I was always connected. And when you grow up in Leamington, you know, when you hear South Detroit, that's pretty much where we grew up. So Leamington is Point Pelee, the southernmost part of Canada, Pelee Island. It's a melting pot, right? All my buddies that I grew up with were all Italians. I grew up in the tomato farms and stuff like this. My dad owned an air conditioning refrigeration company. So I was one of those kids that had a job that you couldn't quit or get fired from. And it was motivation to do whatever it took to play hockey, you know, to make it out and stuff like that. But, you know, growing up in Leamington, it's about 15,000 people at a mile from the old rink. And, you know, it takes a community to raise a child because, you know, from everybody in town, you know, would see me rollerblading or be an opportunity to go skate at the rink before school all the time. And just, I just loved it. And I was supported and in that community, was great, but it was a melting pot. What it taught me is that, you know, you don't judge a book by its cover, you know, no matter race, skin color, whatever, people are people. And I think that, you know, not only being Canadian, but also growing up in Leamington, it exposed you to such the world.
And your introduction to hockey, obviously you grew up rooting for the Red Wings. Who introduced you to hockey for the first time? I know you're in Canada, so that's obviously the sport of choice, but there must have been some maybe little introduction along the way.
My mom was a hockey player. My mom was the first captain of the Essex Blue Angels. You know, my uncle Jack Roberts was a big football hockey player in the area. So it's funny because they said, I got everything. You know what I mean? I got the work ethic and the talent or whatever else. But it was my mom pretty cool because it's her passion of the game, more so her love of sports. That's where my love of sports has come from. So I watch sports, but my mom, Roberta's the biggest, you know, sports fan in our family.
And Darren, you went off to Belleville, as you like to call it, Bell Vegas, to play some junior hockey in the Ontario Hockey League. You claim that you were not that great of a player growing up, but your last year of junior, you had 127 points, 55 goals. So you're doing something right, man.
Well, you know what? My whole thing was always that I was not going to make it because of me. I would do whatever it took. It was, if I wasn't meant to, if it wasn't part of my path, it wasn't meant to be, it wasn't because I didn't give everything on my end. You know, like, that's one of the things, is I don't live by what ifs. You know, unfortunately, I've made some suspect decisions living that way in the past, but it's one of those things, is that you give everything you got and you don't turn around and go, well, if I would have done that, or if I done that. That bothers me the most, when people say, oh, I could have, if I would have only, so why didn't you? Right? If it's that important. So, you know, but Belleville, what it is, is that I learned early. I was told, see, I'm simple. Like we were talking before, I'm meek, man. You tell me what I asked you, how did you do that? And somebody says, well, in order to get there, you got to do this. And if it's going through, like, honestly, 10 feet of cement wall, well, if that's what gets me to the goal, and I decide that that's what I'm going to take on, well, I'm going to get through that wall. I don't know how long it's going to take me, but the thing is, I'm either going to die trying to get through it, or I'm going to get through it. Now, why I say that is because Brian Drum's the most influential guy in my hockey career. When I moved away from Leamington, after playing Bantam hockey, and went to play Junior B hockey, he was my coach. And he's told me, he made it cup of coffee and a minor league guy and pro hockey guy. And he said that in order to make it to the NHL, you got to do one thing better than 99.9% of everybody else. And for you, it'll be playing physical and fighting and stuff like that. And I was like, perfect, good, okay. You know, so every year that it's a simple, if you look back, and the game's changed now, but the way that it was, is your first year in any league, all you do is establish yourself physically, fight, hit, do all that, work on your game in practice, put all the time in, first on, last off, all that. That's all it. And then that buys you space, and then that gives you an opportunity to develop your skills. So I went from like 12 goals my first year to 30 my second year, and 55 my third year. The best part about winning player of the year and scoring 55 goals my last year is that my grind line linemate, Kurt Malpe, had a great junior year. He had 50 goals that year, but I had 55.
Ask him. You hold that. You hang that over his head, right?
I got it so good over his head that when we're in a conversation and somebody brings up, oh, Maltz, you or something, Mac, you had this in junior. I said, oh, but Maltz, and he'll finish the sentence for me. Well, yeah, Mac at 55. He had better, like this. Shut up and walk away. It's the only thing I can get him on. That's for sitting beside me for years, and freaking torturing me by putting letters and numbers in my Sudoku or my crossword, right? So, freaking Malpe.
Well, that's what you have to do. It's like when you have a sibling, right? My older brother's 2 years older than me. He can kick my ass, but the little things that the few things that I was able to do better than him, I hang that over his head to this day. And he's 31, and I'm 29, man.
That's it. That's like Drapes. I'll be 49 this year, but Drapes will be 50. So he's the oldest. Remember that. Draper, May 24th. Happy birthday. It's his 50th.
You're going to have to send him something funny. I don't know what you could do.
We always do. Dude, he's always the oldest.
Send him here's an idea for you. And you could just say, don't say it came from me. Get him a 1 pound gummy bear. One of those giant gummy bears from Amazon. Because if you think about it, what's somebody going to do with a 1 pound gummy bear?
I know exactly. I figured, you know what? Those guys will drill a hole in it and friggin' empty a bottle of vodka in it and fucking let it soak and then eat the bear, the sick bastard.
You were drafted by the Red Wings in the second round back in 1992. What did it mean to you to be drafted by the team that you grew up watching, dude? It's like a dream scenario.
You look at the way that it's played out, but to be able to be drafted by the team you grew up rooting for, and also knowing, because they sucked. They were the Dead Wings. You know, so like growing up and stuff, but the one thing is, you might beat us, but we're going to beat the shit out of you. We have Proby and Kosher and, you know, stuff like that. So to get drafted to the team, I remember I was in Montreal Forum, and somebody asked me the other day, what was it like? And, you know, when they said 46 overall, Belleville Bulls right winger, and this jolt went from my toes all the way through my body, out the top of my head. It was like this. I heard my dad yell and my mom sort of shriek, and it was just like, yeah. But it wasn't like that. Was just, okay, next step, right? And I always knew that I wasn't making the Wings my first year. I had to go down to the minors, but I used the same philosophy. I had 45 majors that year, scored 19 goals, 278 penalty minutes with fucking no tens. you know, that's some work. But it established myself so that the way timing was that for camp in the 93-94 season, Detroit made a change, brought in Scotty Bowman, you know, and I was able to make myself valuable enough because I always knew growing up and everything that once Joey left, Proby needed a Robin to his Batman. You know, Bob Probert, the heavyweight champion, but he needed guys to fight off the slough and stuff like this. So, I mean, you think about it. All my buddies that I grew up with and stuff were all going to University of Windsor too. So they all had a house underneath the bridge, and it was awesome, living the dream come true. And here's the one thing is that where I look back and it's like I said, is that I always knew who I was to everybody else. And at the end of the day, I was always the last to me because, you know, there's one thing when you grow up in a small town and you get out and everything else, you have this sort of guilt, you know, like if you don't maximize it with your stories or the opportunities and, you know, I don't know. It's just that mentality because you're the one that got out. So there's a weight on your shoulders. It's not a real weight. You know, you put it on yourself. It's fake, but it's also too is your self-awareness of who you want to be. And when you've lived your life and you're just going a million miles an hour at the destination, a million miles an hour, when you don't realize the destination's an oasis, then what do I mean? Well, you're a human being. That means when you achieve goals, you want more. You know, I make to the NHL. I want to win a Stanley Cup. You know, I win a Stanley Cup. I want to win another one. I win another, you know, so on and stuff like that. So it's about self-awareness. And that a lot of it was that I know for me, it's not feeling that guilt or whatever like that, because I did everything in my ability to get out. And that was something that I didn't learn till the understanding of the why. Right. That's what Darren McCarty is all about now is I need to know the why. I don't need to know yes or no. I can handle that, you know, right or wrong. But I need to know why we're doing it or, you know, why do I think this way? Why do I operate this way? And if I can figure it out, then I'm not afraid to let everybody know because I've lived my life. That's the beauty of what God set me up with is being transparent through all my struggles to now. To be able to talk to you, to be able to reach out, to know that, hey, what you do is not who you are. And if you want to be better, you can. And I feel like I'm a proof of that.
Hockey players are known to be tough, you know, rough and tough, and you're missing teeth and you have scars. And it's just this tough, barbaric-esque sport. And I think a lot of people associate with being tough and not being open and honest about your feelings or the struggles that you're going through. Why have you been so upfront and honest?
Because I think that, you know, that's a great point because that's sort of you are supposed to be this, you know, it's sort of the thing as what it's like being a man, being a hockey player, being a man or whatever, you're supposed to have these attributes and you're not supposed to show weakness and stuff like that. But that's not the truth because we're all human. And I'm more what I realize instead of hiding the monster or trying to avoid the monster, I'll turn around and face it. You know, there's no monster that's too big that I haven't faced. So the fact that if people want to face their monsters, I'll help them, you know, because I've already faced mine. I know where they are. They're still here. They're except we're friends now. We realize, you know, they realize that it's, and that's where the surrender goes to. So the whole thing is that everything I talk about is the work that I've done. And when I talk about it, I'm also listening to myself because I have to apply it because if I don't, then I'm just another, you know, I might as well be in politics, you know? So, that's not me. So that's when I preach, get educated, get medicated. And then don't tell me what, tell me who, right? Because then we can get through everything else. And if my who and your who line up in a win-win, well, my people, your people, then we're doing what we're doing. Doesn't matter, right? It's letting people know, I don't care what you do, but this is what I'm doing. And if you're not doing what I'm doing, fuck off, double, or else there's a fight. Not just with me, with everybody I've surrounded myself with, because we're old enough now, like I said, to understand. And so that's the beauty of the transparency and whatever else. And it's, and how long did I suffer because of that stigma and stuff like that? Years. But the point is that society's changed. We're more open. We're more educated on different things. So it's okay to not be okay. Right. So you got to get it out. That's the biggest thing. No matter what it is that you learn, you can't leave it in here. You got to get it out. And you know what? No matter what, you're going to be all right.
You kind of hit on something where you eventually tackled those monsters. And it's almost like you took your playing career and channeled that into tackling the off ice demons, because D-Mac, you were the guy that I watched growing up. You would go after anybody. Like, it didn't matter who you are, how big you were going in there.
And I look at it the same way as you see the Red Wing behind me, right? That I live, bleed to this day. I haven't taken it off. It's melted into my heart. It's part of who I am. But I've taken this cannabis plant and I put it on my chest, because that is also the vulnerable truth with integrity that needs to be faced. So here's the whole point, Colin, is that when I finally decided on November 11th, 2015, to fight again, because I spent, since I retired to whatever, I didn't care. And it was like leaving Las Vegas, not trying to kill myself, but I literally had gotten to 275 pounds. My blood pressure was 260 over 145 or something. Like, the reason I didn't stroke out or have a heart attack was the fact of all the cannabis in my system that was protecting me to learn. So the education. But so you're right. When I decided to fight, right, I made that choice that moment. And because I'm one of those people that I will accomplish whatever I put my mind to. What am I going to put my mind to accomplishing? So if it's sobriety, and that's the way I want the fight. But the whole thing is I couldn't do it myself. And I had the support system and the people around me. And that's you look around to your left and right. And that's where I can tell you is that from my wife, Cheryl, who I wrote about in my book, My Last Fight, Story of a Hockey Rockstar, which I wrote. It's funny, coming up on like 9 years ago, I started writing that. And so much things have changed. But a lot of it, looking back, is that's the nitty gritty of the fight, but why it's worth fighting. And so it's one of these things is that this is who I am. I'm like anybody else. If I believe that, and this is what we learned from Scotty Bowman on the ice, is that you can make that mistake once. So if you want to change it, then you are responsible for changing it. And what have you done? What have you put in to get out? Bottom line, what if you want something? What have you done to deserve that? What have you put in the work? You know, so instead of looking around and pointing fingers, it's all about pulling thumbs and looking at yourself, and it's self-awareness. I always tell everybody, at the end of the day, look in that mirror and don't lie to that person. And when you can have an honest conversation, you can lie to everybody else. But the fact is, you don't lie to that person. How do I know this? Because I would ignore them for so long, being embarrassed who it was. One day I looked and I said, I'm not dealing with you right now. And he looked back at me and said, hope you're alive when you come back. I was like, oh, you're swarmy. And then we started to have a conversation to get to the bottom of it. And if that's where it starts, where you can look yourself in the mirror and call yourself out on your bullshit and call yourself out on why you want to be better or why you want to be worse. Either or. I don't give. It's that conversation, right? The universe will conspire with you positively or negatively, whichever way you want, right? So now it's just trying to use the influence and having fun, being able to connect. And for me, it's about connecting the people. And it's about culture. And it's to remind you and your age group and stuff of who you are and why you are. And you know, why are you a Darren McCarty fan? Well, it's because of this and because of that, or who is the person? Well, we're still living. Like you said, you give me a call when you get into the kids. And, you know, we were talking earlier, mine are between 17 and 27 right now. So you got a whole life ahead of you. But the whole thing is that we're all a part of the same culture. We're all a part of what it's meant to be. And, you know, one of the things now is just preparing everybody for what's coming, you know, in the Red Wing, because it's not Steve Eisman at the helm. It's not when, it's when. So I'm going to guess 4 or 5 years. Took them 8 in Tampa, take him half the time here. That's the way he rolls.
I think the hard part, Darren, and the challenge for all of us is to have that honest dialogue with yourself. Look at yourself in the mirror and acknowledge what you see looking back at you, because I'll be the first one to tell you, I had my own struggles in my early 20s, and I knew what I saw in the mirror, but I just ignored the heck out of it. I was at Arizona State having a great time. I ignored it, dude. And you want to know where that led? Didn't lead to a great place. It probably set me back maybe 10 years. 2.5 years of just damaging set me back about 10 years, man.
But that's your story. But that's part of your journey. But you did. So it set you back. Okay, whatever. But I'd look at it like that's not your path. Your path is the fact that we're having this conversation, and you know that. And it's okay to ignore that person. But when you, the problem is when you want to stop ignoring that person and you can't. It's one of those of who you want to be and who, what's your path and when you want to change. Right. So there's, you got to a point and trust, if you trust me at all, so it doesn't matter when you're talking addiction or whatever, no matter how many times, so you're talking booze, pills, whatever you're talking about, right? Is that trust me, if you trust me at all, is that where you ended, right? You just stop and put it on pause, because I've been sober for years and years and years and gone back to it over time, and you're right where you left off. Which means you don't reset, you don't whatever, you're right back in the depths of your addiction, right? So in knowing that, is that, and when you understand, like, when you understand what you're up against and that you're fighting the losing battle, if that's the battle that you're fighting, right? And it's all self-awareness, everybody's different. You know, to me now, like alcohol, you can put alcohol and all those are the same thing. I don't have no deal. You put a Mountain Dew up there, dude. Ah, ha, ha.
Wait, you said you say olives?
Olives, I hate olives.
You're not an olive? Come on, dude. No olives?
Only Israeli olives. When I was in Israel with the Russian 5 movie, I ate 3 of them on a bet, and they were actually good. But yeah, no olives, dude. My guys fuck with me in the pizza, because they're going to eat pizza and then they'll put an olive on it and on one piece, and then they know I can't eat pizza.
Well, that's a smart, I gotta tell you, I think that's a smart move.
On their part.
Yeah, on their part. For you, unfortunately, you get to miss out on the pizza, especially if it's buddies.
Calling, yeah, exactly. Remember, he's buying the fucking pizza too.
Your time with the Wings, you played with so many guys. And my favorite moment it was probably the Grindline days. You, Malpe, and Draper, you guys just destroyed some of the best lines in the NHL. What made the Grindline so successful?
You know what? Looking back to it, I think that all three of us coming out of the OHL or growing up like similarly in Kirk Malpe, and grew up in Hespler, Ontario, which is, you know, hour outside Toronto, and Drapes was a Toronto kid. So we're all Ontario boys and played in the OHL, and just, I know I was coached by Larry Mavity and Junior, and Drapes was coached by Brian Kilray, rest their souls, are two of the icons in junior hockey. And you know what? It was one of these things is that I believe because we were as close off the ice as we were on the ice, we thought on one wavelength. I think that the three of us had exceptional hockey IQ, right? That's the one thing that, you know, is that I pride myself on. I was a freaking awful skater, but the fact is that but you know, that was the thing. I mean, I told Drapes, I said, if I could skate like you, it'd be unfair. I mean, like, geez, I mean, it'd be like, the game would be so easy. You got to put some work in, but it was the fact that we trusted each other. We were on the same wavelength. So even though we played like a system, we always had each other's back, but we also knew where we would go. And a lot of it was because we would practice against the Russian 5. We practiced against Yzerman and Shanahan. We practiced against Lidstroms. We practiced against Hall of Famers the whole time. So that's what made us great. And we took the most pride in the fact to shut down the other team's top line, whether it was the Legion of Doom in the 97 finals, or Sakic or Forsberg and all those Colorado battles. That was our pride. And then, you know, when the big guys couldn't get her going, Drapes would look and go, okay, boys, Grindline go tonight. You know, then we've all scored big goals and had big moments. And You know, we're an integral part, but we relished our roles. They relished their roles as two of the best penalty killers of their era. And obviously the check in line, but we could also score. So, you know, there's, you know, Drates ended up winning the Selke the 1 year and putting up 20 some goals. If you could score on a breakaway, you'd have 40, you'd be a 40 goal man. But, you know, again, Maltz and I had, you know, we could score. You know what I mean? That wasn't our number one thing. It was either checking or being physical and stuff. But when it came down to it, we scored some big goals, and that's what we're proud of.
The grind line was my favorite line to watch. I think people that knew hockey on a basic level or loved the Red Wings were always thinking, they would always mention Stevie and Shanny and Lidstrom and all the guys. And in my head, I always felt like you're missing out. You got McCarty, Maltby, Draper. They will lock you down and wear you out. And I loved it.
But it was a different, because it was almost like the different, you go out there in the Russian five and it'd be all pretty and Stevie and Eisman and stuff. You get the offense and then it'd be like, all right, here comes the guy. You know, like, here's the shit show, right? What are they going to do? They're running somebody, sticking somebody. Somebody's getting face washed. Somebody's, you know, laying out. There's going to be multiple guys laying on the ice, you know, like, it was a different, that's what made it effective in the way that Scotty Bowman, I always say, he's not the greatest, just the greatest coach of all time. He's the greatest psychologist, right? Because he taught you that you don't treat everybody the same. Because if you tell Sergei Fedorov, you need to do this, this, this more, and you tell Darren McCarty, don't ever do that again, it's the same message, bro. So it's all, and it's just the fact of, it's the same message.
Is that what he said to you, Darren McCarty? Yeah, don't do that again, bro.
He would, yes, I could get away with a lot of things once, and that's the way that it would work. So Scotty saved my life a bunch of times by not letting me fight guys that wanted to fight me, usually the big heavyweights or something like that. So I owe him for not getting my ass kicked a few times, because he'd tell me not to. He'd stand on the bench and go, if I fight this guy, you'll never play a shift for me again. And I'd be like, you hurt him. What am I going to do?
How would you describe your relationship with Drapes? You guys were on the grind line together. Obviously, after Lemieux just drives his head into the boards and essentially breaks his face, you get back, get some retribution. How close are you guys, and what has he meant to you?
Well, he's the closest thing that I have to a brother. You know, he's the older brother, always the, you know, even though he's a year older, I think you can relate more to having a two-year-old brother, but always looked out, always, you know, tried for the best. You know, the one thing with Drapes is that it's even when the worst, I was the worst of the worst, it's sort of, you knew he was at most guys like at a distance, but always, you know, always there when I was ready to put the work in, which led us back to, you know, the comeback in 2007. So, I mean, that just tells you that everything that we've been through. And then, and this is like 10 years after winning the cup, and the lockout had happened and I wasn't in a good place. I just finished in Calgary and I'd come off my third sport hernia surgery and I was in a bad place and come out of rehab and I came back to Detroit and it was December 07. And in the beginning, I remember, and I just had lunch with Drapes and I said, dude, you know what? It's like, it was that I got something left, or it was that what if, don't live by what ifs. And I was like, dude, he had this workout facility, and Drapes is always like, if you follow Stevie and Drapes around, like, Drapes would get sick if he didn't work out, whereas, like, I get sick if I did. You know what I mean? I'm so old school. It's just, like, go out and do it. But it was always, like, when you needed your workout advice or what to do, it just, you know, Drapes was your guy. So he had this core workout place that he hooked me up with his trainer. And I went in the gym, started skating, got it to a point where he was involved with the IHL team in Flint. And I just said, you know, give me a trial. Let me go play like this. So it worked out. And, you know, this is where Kenny Holland, who we call him Uncle Kenny, because he's as close to, and like, we're all real close. You know, me, Drapes, Ozzy, Marty Lapointe, all the guys, his kids he drafted and stuff like this. And now he's a GM in Edmonton and stuff. But it was just being on the radar. Nothing was promised. It was just the opportunity. And I seized it and then was able to find the love back in Flint in the IHL. And then I got a tryout in Grand Rapids. My first game in Grand Rapids, I had a hat trick. And eventually proved enough to Mike Babcock that, you know, the big thing is, you know, it wasn't about playing. It was being in the locker room, right, with Drapes and Ozzy and Maltz and Z and Pavel and, you know, Dallas Drake and Nick and Homer, and these are my guys, right? So it was like the last sort of hurrah, but the fact that Holmstrom got hurt and Franzen got hurt in the first and second rounds, I was able to play 17 out of 22 games, even scored a goal and got my name on the fourth cup. So, you know, that just goes, you know, that's that one's special just because, you know, don't tell me you can't do whatever you want. And again, I use that mentality and to getting where I am right now. Now that's the hardest fight that I've had, but, you know, like, so to answer your question is that, you know, not only one of my best friends, but, you know, he's always been that brother. You know, it's like I don't have a brother, but if I did it, you know, I would equate that to the relationship that we have.
Before the lockout, obviously, you and the Wings part ways. Then you go up to Calgary. How difficult was it to leave the franchise that you not only grew up watching, but the team that you grew up busting your ass for, and the city? You're beloved by everybody in the city and the entire state.
You know, it was one of those things that was tough, but you got to look at it as it was more of, you know, I see my responsibility. You know, I had the lockout year and stuff like that. I decided to go play Rockstar with Grindr instead of hockey. I was sort of burned out because the game sort of had changed and I was, you know, older and it turned into more of a job. But going to Calgary was awesome. You know, Daryl Sutter's the coach there now. That's who I played for my first year. Played with Jerome McGinley, just got in the NHL Hall of Fame, and Robin Regier, Rhett Warner, Mika Kuprashov, Chris Simon. I had a blast. Tony Amonte, we had a blast. You know, we actually lost in seven the first round to Anaheim that went on to win the cup that year. So my first year was awesome. Loved those guys. I played on the Grindline 2.0 with Marcus Nielsen and Stefan Yell, who I battled against.
In Colorado. Yeah, Stefan Yell, yeah.
Sandbox. That's what we call him, Sam. He's, oh, man, he is so, he's like, him and Drake are so much alike in a lot of ways. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so we got along great. I mean, he's one of the best teammates. And I had a blast. It was like playing junior again, the mentality it was, and had fun. But then I got hurt, and then didn't see eye to eye with Jim Playfair, who replaced Daryl Sutter. And so that led me back into my addiction. But it worked out eventually, brought me back to Detroit and won another cup. So, but it was tough, but it was one of those things that, you know, it was more of my doing than anything just because of my choices. But again, you know, I don't, I'll usually make the mistake and not make it again, you know, but it's one of those things that this is what I did. This is how it played out. So be aware of what's important. And, you know, like how, that's what I said. It's your life path. You have an idea, but you're not in control, you know? So that's just the way it was supposed to go. I don't live with regrets, but it's definitely, I see more of my responsibility. And if, you know, that was 80-20 on my doing, I made it as easy as possible, I guess, the way that it played out. But again, when you drop the salary cap from 60, when you have a 60-something million payroll to under 40, you know, and you're making, you know, when you're making money like $2.5 million, then you're the guy to go.
When did the heavy drinking begin? Was that something that started during the junior days or early years with the Red Wings? When did that all begin?
Oh, dude, I come from an alcoholic family and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's like, that's the whole thing is, I mean, you're either drinking or, you know, when you're young. I remember I was 14, probably, stuff like this. And it was always that thing, but it was always the hockey that tempered it, right? You know what I mean? The career that always tempered it. So, I mean, my sobriety is not like everybody else. I go years sober, right? Like I never drank out of the cup till 2013, which was when I was drinking again, because every time we won the cup I was sober, which I apologize, we should have 12 cups, yeah, but it doesn't work out that way if I was sober. But so you can tell the different if you go back chronologically and stuff like that. So it's just one of these things that's a disease. And like I mentioned to you before, you know, I've millions and millions of hours in AA and four treatment facilities, $1 million league spent on me. The whole thing is I live my principles by Alcoholics Anonymous, except my program has a garden. And what I mean by that is that cannabis plant and the CBD and the CBN and the sleep and being an insomniac. And I realized that I was more of an insomniac because I drank to pass out than it was, or anxiety, or, you know, just different things playing the role that you are, that leads into it, not only to be able to turn off the fun meter, right? Like you say, Drake's always, it's always trying to keep me off the shots, right? Like, if you could keep me to beer, I was fine, but I could, you know, Drake would always joke is that there's Mac disappearing into the bar with some chicks doing shots, you know, like, that's just the way it was. And to have gone, cause I was the one of those that I got sick when I didn't drink, not when I drank, you know, like it was like that physical addiction. So to be able to, through Rick Simpson oil, through the plant, to get that physical addiction out of my body, you know, like, that was the greatest gift of God. So, I mean, like, I have no inkling. I know what it is, and it's the surrender. The one thing is that I don't have to fight it anymore, because I know there's certain things that if I drink, I die. I don't want to do that anymore. You know, there's a time between 2009 and 2015 where I didn't really care. Now I do.
For those that are big fans of you and that have helped support you along the way, Darren, how do you describe that dark, dark place? Like, is there even a way to be able to describe it? Because I think everyone's always curious, like, how do you, like, what's going on, like, in your mind, body, and soul to get to that point?
You just don't care. Like, it's the mentality, excuse me, that either you're alone, that nobody understands you, that nobody can go through it, that nobody's got the pressure you have or whatever. That's why you got to get it out. It's communication. It's facing the monster. And that's the thing, is when I don't care, right? See, because I realize that I'm a battery. The people are my power. And the compassion that I have is for the person that is in the place that I was, or not even the place I go. Because they say, you know, rock bottom. No, bullshit. It's an infinite hole. You'll keep digging. You'll keep digging until you're done, right? And that's what you realize. So the power of strength to be able to let people know is that I've been there. Because I don't think anybody could. There's very few that could come back to where that I was. Not only physically, but also mentally. But also, too, it's the same thing that drove me to play in the NHL and to do whatever it took. Going back to that wall analogy, was the same thing that once, it was all about getting that physical addiction gone, right? It was of alleviating that anxiety, that being able to sleep. So that's where the CBN, which is part of the CBD and all the plant, to be able to pinpoint. And then to understand how education and stuff like this, how to go, is it's I get it about people that could see. The reason that I couldn't commit suicide is because I'm too egotistical, right? And I mean, at the end of the day, when it would come down to that, it'd be like, look in the mirror and go, who are you fucking kidding? You know what I mean? That's not, you know, everything you do, you know, and having to have that top remind myself who I am. Right. You know what I'm saying? And lead that way. So if I don't talk it and I don't walk it, that's what I do, because that's me leading, because it's not my responsibility. Who hears me is this, and I know that somebody out there needs to hear this, because as long as you do not quit, you're always in the game. And it doesn't matter how close to being out of the game you are. That's irrelevant. It's just, do you want it? And what I look for, and here's the difference, what I had to realize, that if you're not going to put in the work, then I have to be respectful enough for my time to not deal with you, because there's somebody that wants to put the work in. So it's not the fact that, like, I got my own program to run. I know what works for me. I'm still a work in progress. I have work to do on myself, but I can, if you're willing to do the work. I always say, I'm not here to argue, but I'm here for, what do you mean by that? What do you mean? And go and do the work. My right hand, Aaron, whose story is even more incredible than mine, who is from the streets of Flint, white kid, grew up in the hood and stuff like this, that our connection is cannabis. He has no idea what sports are or whatever this, but he's been my right hand for the last 5 years. And he's my, what do you mean by that? And if you want to see growth in somebody and to have developed that somebody who come from, you know, nothing or whatever else, and always realize that there was something bigger and now put the work in. So that's all it is. I'm just looking for people that want to put the work in and have questions. Well, what did you mean by that? Well, let's break it down and try so that you can understand. But it's the worst feeling is when you don't care about anything. Right. And then to be able to, and to be able to be honest and say, you know, kids can't, there's no physical thing, and it's nothing like it, and it's not about your kids and stuff like that. But when you're in pain or you're numb or you don't care that nothing matters, that's when it's, that's that area where I understand where people, you know, commit suicide or, you know, don't. It's to keep them out, to let them know that they never have to go there as long as they're willing to put the work in.
How important is the self-awareness aspect? Because I think your wife or your friends, people can tell you everything, but if at the end of the day, and you've touched on this, it comes down to you. If you're not willing to make the changes, if you're not willing to take those steps, then it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks or what anybody else says.
Here's the biggest key, right? When I say that what anybody else thinks about me is none of my fucking business. When I say that, it is one thing. When I live that 100% and got to that point from caring, living as I, the last one at the party, gonna miss something, you know, the what ifs and, you know, all that, from going from that to going to, I don't give a, it's not my responsibility what you think about me. You know, it's, that's your opinion. So self-awareness is number one. And self-awareness could be even two, is that, you know, one of the things that I learned with all that rehab is, it's called the heart virtue, and your heart virtue is what makes you tick, right? Mine is vulnerable truth with integrity. So when I'm in a room and shit's off, right, where it's people should be uncomfortable because it's a vulnerable truth, hence March 26, hence whatever, that's when I shine. Right. When the going gets tough, that's when I feel more comfortable. That's when I get calm, you know, then that's just the self-awareness of the responsibility I like, because it's not the fact that I like to fight. It's not the fact that I want to go first, but my fear of anybody going before me is greater than my fear of death. That makes sense. Right. Because you get by me, I go first. I'm leading the charge. You get by me, I'm probably dead. Right. But I don't want any of my guys to they know that I'm going in head first. So I get that mentality of when you watch history of kings leading their armies into battle and stuff like that. That's the way, it's the way you're built. So it's asking these questions. Why do I think that way? It all goes back to the why. And self-awareness, I believe, is the key, because it's the same thing as, oh, if you see somebody doing something that, wow, you want to do, what are they, how are they doing it, or what are they doing to do it? If you see that, most people go, oh, that's too hard. Okay, well, you're not willing to do it. Other people would be like, oh, man, that seems a little bit easier, right? It's all perspective of what you want to be. And it's okay if you don't know. Just keep being honest. You're not supposed to know. You have an idea. And then it's like, okay. And then sometimes life throws you a curveball. But it's all about being true to yourself. That's number one.
You know, you bring up a, I mean, you brought up so many great points, but I think, like, for instance, in the broadcasting industry, if you're in TV, you usually start off in a small town, then you move up to a mid-market, then you get to a major market. Sometimes some people skip those steps and they get right to the big time. And there's so much jealousy that is shifted towards those people. And in my head, DMAC, I think, wow, like, that's amazing. Like, good for that person. How do I get better? How do I get to this point?
Work harder. Like, that's it. Work harder. What have they done? I'd want that successful person as somebody that I question, you know? Like, I want to see you want to do the work. When you're not afraid, that you know that the bottom line is, what do you put in to get out? and it's hard work. Well, then you're not, obviously he's doing something you're not doing, or she's doing something you're not doing. And it's finding those people, because more times than not, you find the right one that wants to share the knowledge, and then you grow together. That's the whole thing, Woodward Sports Network, why, you know, I've committed to do this afternoon show from 3 to 5 Eastern every day, is to be able to bring some sort of not only sports, and, you know, obviously betting in Michigan is big, but also some levity, some gravity to life. And, you know, like, you know, sports and hockey is what I did. It's not who I am, you know, but, you know, it's part, a big part of my life, because it's what I'm around all the time and what I enjoy.
I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's just important, instead of thinking, if you really want something, you got to go out and get it. You got to seize the moment, figure out a way to do it. And it's going to be a grind, right? You're going to have to ask for help.
And here's the thing, right? Sometimes the greatest gift is the one that you don't get. That's the one that you think you want so bad, and it doesn't happen, and then it plays out, right? So you got to trust the process. You know, are you, and at the end of the day, are you doing the best to your ability? Are you, and if you are, then you got to wipe your hands and move on, because, dude, you can't control it. I mean, it's the whole thing is that it's like, if you've done your best and you've cleaned your plate, then why are you going to worry about it? Because you can't change it.
When did you get introduced to cannabis, and has it, in some ways, I get the idea that it's saved your life.
Oh, Dad, no, it did. If you look at anything, cannabis saved my life. You know what I'm saying? Then I grew up that here's a beer, but if you smoke a joint, you'll never make it to the NHL. So my cannabis journey was always, I was buddies with the stoners, but we could drink, but you couldn't smoke, because that was such a misnomer until my first sport hernia surgery in 99. And they were filling me with pills, and like I said, insomnia, couldn't do it, that I finally, my buddy said, just smoke this, man. And it was like game changer, where I realized, like Ricky Williams, like the football player, that, wow, this is bigger than life. Like, this, something's the, wait a sec, why does this change everything? Or why does this bring, you know, allow me to sleep or get everything else off it? So I knew there was something there. Obviously, the education and stuff like this, and obviously I didn't really go to it, but when I needed it the most, and like I said earlier, I was literally, my organs were about to explode. I was like literally probably a couple weeks from, you know, being dead, because shit blowing up. And it was through the love of the cannabis community, and I had a caregiver and stuff, and they took Rick Simpson oil, which is RSO, which is a plant concentrated down, and it's extracted with alcohol, which is, so the alcohol that killed me saved me with this plant. And then I did 8 days of 10 to 15 grams a day detox that I was out for almost 8 days. And when I came to, the physical addiction of the alcohol was gone. I was on my knees and I was grateful. And then I was mad, because if I was lied to like this and they got to this point, and like I said, I got to that dark place and didn't need to and stuff, that pissed me off. So then I got educated. Then I started to get educated. Then I put myself into it as much, until the fact that in here I got with Pincana. Pincana is the largest seed to sale producer of cannabis in the state of Michigan. We got together, win-win, and aligned our properties. So I created the Darren McCarty brand. Right here, as you can see, which is Laura State approved with the cannabis plant, the fist, and the 25. And this is my CBD roll-on that is e-commerce, so it ships everywhere. It's just given me an opportunity, you know. Now And obviously I'm huge in the cannabis community here in Michigan and throughout, as far as judges and stuff like that. But it was, it's just an opportunity, you know, to be able to walk it and talk it, you know, and put out my own stuff. And when you say, don't tell me what, tell me who. And it's one of the things, like everything, is navigating people through, you know, the cannabis and, you know, whatever it is, because I believe, you know, the bottom line is, it's not whether you do or you don't. It's, you know, you have an option, right? The minute you tell me yes, I'm on to the next person. You tell me no, then we go, do you know about the endocannabinoid system? And then they say no. And I say, well, everything with a spine has one, and this plant is specifically for that, like a food processor. So it's your responsibility to get it in, and your body will do with it, with the food processor, the endocannabinoid system, what it is. So now when you figure out what you need, you're your own doctor. And that's the beauty of it.
Dr. McCarty.
That's it, baby.
When do you have any guys, current or former NHL guys, have they come to you to ask about your experience with cannabis and how it's helped?
A lot of former, and a lot of it through the Athletes for Care, or, you know, it's like Scott Parker, Riley Cote, you know, they're different things out there. A lot of the concussion stuff that they're, the psilocybin and the microdosing mushrooms and stuff, where the guys for the concussions, the PTSDs, they're on that train. I'm on the cannabis train and stuff like that. But yeah, more and more and more and more. And, you know, my goal is to have these in every NHL locker room, you know, eventually, to be able to, you know, produce the stuff that I know that they need under the guidelines of what will help, so that gets them away from the pills. But yeah, a lot of retired, a lot of alumni guys, a lot of guys in different sports. So it's all about the communication. And again, you know, it's still young at some sort of point. So it's all about education. And that's the whole thing with the cannabis journey. I ain't telling you this, that, or whatever. I'm telling you what works for me, and I'm telling you this, but you got to go on your own little journey.
It's an option, and I think that's the best part about it, Darren, is it's not, you go to the doctor and they give you a pill, right? And I think the old school mentality is, oh, this is my only option. And when it's not, and there are other options. My parents were into the homeopathic stuff and really into that. And so I, as a kid, I was always thinking, what the heck am I, what is this? But, you know, as I've gotten older, I've realized that there are options out there. And that's the most important thing for people.
Options is key, right? You're an American or Canadian or whatever, where you get a freedom of choice, right? So this is all about your choice. In fact, I prefer you don't, more for me, but.
We'll produce a commercial for you. And at the end, we'll say, I prefer if you don't have cannabis, more for me.
Don't like it, more for me, but, you know, the humanitarian in me.
If you could go back in time, Darren, what would you tell a young DMAC?
Listen to the people that are around you, you know, figure out who, you know, try to figure out who you want to be earlier than not. You don't have to be everything to everybody. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, you know, but it's also too, is that I look back and I go, the person, you know, I had to live that way to play. You know what I mean? It's a mentality that I wouldn't change, because I know that needed me to get there. Like, this person here isn't that person. God bless it. You know what I mean? Because I guess so. What I would say is that trust the people around you that have your best interests. You know, sometimes when you're younger, you think, you don't listen to the people that you should, you know, that's where I come in, you know, that's where it is. If I look back, some of the decisions that I made, but again, it's part of my path. I mean, I can't change anything, because then, you know, that jeopardizes the cups, that jeopardizes everything else. So we'll just, the fact that I'm still here, we're going to just leave it the way it is.
And again, I appreciate the openness, because again, it goes back to what we chatted about right when we started, how it's, you're a hockey player and you're the tough guy and you're supposed to have this hard exterior and you're not supposed to show emotion and you're not supposed to be vulnerable. I think that's a whole bunch of crap, man.
Well, and you know what? That's the beauty of what your generation has given us, is the transparency and everything, right? The fact that I'm here is through the transparency of this plant, the transparency of being a man. It's, you know, to me, being a man is to own your feelings, not to hide from them, to be able to be vulnerable, but also be tough. So that the fact that I can cry and punch you in the face at the same time makes me dangerous.
You can cry, and then you could take your right hand, your off hand,
and just snap your neck. You know what I mean? I will tear up and then snap your neck just like that, if that's what's called for.
If Darren McCarty in the 90s is skating after me, I'm skating off the ice. I'm figuring out a way to get off the ice.
I wouldn't even fuck with him. So let's not tell you. Because there's no rationale behind that kid, right? There's rationale, right? And you can't get in front of it at his age.
I love that. I would even skate away from him. Darren McCarty, and real quick, I want you to tell everyone what you're up to now, man, in terms of the broadcasting. You have something going out in Detroit, and I would love everyone to know.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started this Woodward Sports Network. You can check it out on, you know, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, every platform, Woodward Sports Network. So I've started this afternoon show, 3 to 5, with Pilar Laster. Used to be a Deal or No Deal lady, and a good friend of mine, Tom Mazzaway, who's sort of the Detroit dad of sports. And what do I compare it to? It's like a Regis and Kathy Lee on crack. So it's
did you say Regis and Kathy Lee on crack?
Yeah, you know, it's a little bit of, you know, sports entertainment. You know, I break down. We're trying to culture Pilar on Detroit, and you know, I break down fights for her and stuff like this. And she wanted to, why do guys do this and do that? And, you know, we talk everything else, obviously, all different sports. Betting's a big thing, so that's a huge angle. That Grind Time with Darren McCarty, which is my podcast, we are going to fire that back up real soon. Anyways, just getting the logistics down with the all-new studio and stuff like that. You can always hit me up, Darren McCarty 4. On Twitter, I run that one. Our blue check mark, Real Darren McCarty's. Those are huge. DarrenMcCarty.com and the Darren McCarty brand. I think that's about it.
See,
not sure. And the band's firing back up once we get to go out again.
Grinders coming back?
Grinders coming back, bro. Yeah, check. Dude, I even got the Hawks.
You got it?
The Hawk is even.
See, yeah, the Hawk, oh, wow. The Hawk, you've been waiting to do that.
Look,
dude.
I've been nurturing it, bro. So we were supposed to come out last summer, but the COVID. But yeah, I mean, we're enjoying it. We're trying to enjoy everything, you know. Just, you know, life's life, and let people know that if they don't ever quit, they're never out of the game.
Listen, Darren, I appreciate you taking the time, and I want to leave you with this. So I told you my family's from Detroit. My brother and I grew up watching you in the Wings. And I asked my brother, I said, Darren McCarty's coming on the podcast. What do you want to ask him? And he was like, no way. He's coming on. I'm like, yeah. And he just wanted from us, he wanted me to say thank you for all the fantastic memories that you gave us with our dad, man. I mean, he passed away about a decade ago. And so some of the things that we have left are the memories with you in the Wings. So thank you for everything, man.
No, I get it, bro, but that's where we're connected. And, you know, that's the whole thing. It's always great, you know, talking, because that's what I'm talking about as far as moving forward as you guys and to embrace those things. My dad's been gone it's coming up on 22 years and stuff, but it gets easier and you enjoy those memories and these moments, because that's, you know, the importance and the fact that, you know, I say, well, you guys don't have to worry because you're one of the 15% that's a DMAC fan. So you guys got common sense. So your old man left you with that. And we're in good shape, and continue to spread the love out there. And excuse me, until you're back. But again, we're all part of the same team, and it'll be exciting when you guys come back in a few years to be able to celebrate some of these Red Wing games.
Darren McCarty, appreciate the time, brother.
You got it, Colin.